Don't we look professional?
Yeah, I think so. That looks pretty good.
Yeah. Okay, so this guy here that I'm talking to is my brother, Anthony Arkin.
And this gentleman here that I'm talking to is my brother, Matthew Arkin.
And we're going to talk about food and movies. And tonight, we are talking about The Verdict. So we have a special guest with us tonight, a gentleman who I've had the privilege of knowing since I was 13 years old, and who I actually made my Broadway debut with, and who plays Dr. Gruber in the movie. So we're going to welcome Louis Stadlin to the show. Hey, Lou. Welcome.
Hi.
Hi, Lou.
Hi, Tony.
I'm trying to think when last time I saw you, when it was a dinner that three of us had, I think 12, 15 years ago.
What did we
put that out there?
What did we eat?
It was probably Chinese food. I think we went to a Chinese restaurant.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. I think so.
Well, okay. I saw you also in those three plays when you and your dad.
The power plays?
Right, the power plays.
Yeah.
And when was that? What year was that?
That was in 97, I think. Mm-hmm. 97, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
With Elaine, and that was quite something.
And Jeannie Berlin.
Did you see it with my pop or with Richard Benjamin?
Oh, no, I wouldn't go to see it unless it was, you know.
Okay.
Your dad.
We had Richard Benjamin did it for a while. He replaced my dad.
I did Portnoy's Complaint, the movie. It's terrible. With Richard Benjamin. I think it was the second movie I ever did. It's the first time I ever went to Los Angeles.
Who directed Portnoy's Complaint? I forget.
Ernest Lehman, who also wrote the screenplay.
Okay.
Yeah. And I got there at the end of the shoot, and everybody went to kill each other.
So I'm dying to talk about The Verdict. I'm dying to talk about this movie.
All right, let's dive in.
I'd seen it before. I hadn't seen it in a long time. It had probably been, 15 years. And I thought I knew it. And it was like a very different movie than I almost had it confused maybe with another film.
Uh-huh.
Even though I know I'd seen it. I may have been too young to appreciate it when I saw it the first time. I don't know. This time, I was completely amazed. How did it... You'd seen it before, right, Matthew?
Yeah, I had seen it before, and I love it. I adore it. I think it's incredibly well constructed. We were chatting before, and it came out at a very interesting time in my life where I had just graduated from college and I was starting law school. And I was going to Fordham in New York City, which is a Catholic university. We had some of the professors were Jesuits. And a lot of my classmates felt like they came from the same background, the same texture of that Irish Catholic. We used to go at lunch between classes because we were in Midtown. We would go to some of those buckets of blood down on 10th Avenue for lunch and eat, from the steam trays, the way he does in the movie, where he's got the eggs. So, growing up a Jew in New York and Westchester, and then suddenly going to school with these people and seeing that movie, it felt like the same world and the same texture, and that I was suddenly immersed in all those kinds of personalities. And of course, as a beginning law student, his idealism really, struck us and appealed to us.
Right.
Now looking back on it, knowing the law better years later, there's so much legally that's, wrong with the movie.
Right.
But that doesn't matter in terms of the story of the film, which is a story of redemption and...
Yeah, it is. I mean, you could argue to what degree this is about his... doing anything for anyone else.
Yeah.
At all. But
exactly.
I mean, I think that's what makes it so interesting. For those who don't know, we'll probably give a lot of spoilers away, but this is a movie's been around for a while. So there's no excuse not to have seen it or pause this and go see it. pause the show and go watch The Verdict and then watch this and catch up with this.
But then you won't be able to ask us questions.
Yeah, well, then we won't know as much. We'll be smarter if you don't. So why don't you not watch the movie?
Right, yeah.
This is a, to just set the table for it, right? This is a legal drama, essentially. It's a courtroom drama, but it's also a character study about a lawyer who's kind of maybe washed up, maybe at the end of his road, and about a case that kind of turns his life upside down and around. And is that a fair assessment of it? You know he drinks in the trailer, but that's about all you know.
And it's his shot. It's his shot at redemption and to fix his life and make something of himself.
It's Rocky for lawyers.
Yes, it is. Yeah. It is.
Like if you were a lawyer, does it hit you in that spot of like, oh, I gotta legal up when I see this movie? It really.
Well, yeah, but it's not. It doesn't strike me as a procedural. You know, it doesn't get into the finer points of procedure. I really agree more with what you said of it being a character study. But the one thing I do think is, you know, you said the thing about we can argue about whether or not who he does it for. Is it for himself or for them?
Mm-hmm.
And I think it changes in the middle. There was a very specific moment for me that I noticed where when he goes to the hospital to take the pictures of her and they're developing, that's where I felt it ceased being for him and started being to do something right. For once in his life, because the subtext of that moment to me was that as the pictures develop, he sees her for the first time and she becomes.
That's interesting. My favorite single shot in history, probably.
Really?
And I want to ask Lou questions in a second, but that shot was equally amazing to me and I took away a completely different thing from it.
Really? What did you take away from it?
I believed it was his developing sense of the case. I saw it purely as a response to, oh, I can do this.
Oh, interesting.
And a more of a mechanical realization and awakening of his shot, what I can do with this situation. Anyway, Lou, do you know the moment we're talking about? The shot with the Polaroids?
No. I haven't seen it in a long time.
Okay.
He goes to the hospital to take pictures of the victim to bring to the archdiocese. And as he's taking them, he stops. And and the other thing that struck me about that, he stops and he watches the pictures develop, their Polaroids. And a nurse comes into the room and says, "Sir, you can't be here." And he says, "I'm her lawyer."
Right.
And that to me was, again.
However, he doesn't watch it develop. We do. There is no shot of him watching those Polaroids develop. There is only a close-up of them developing. So from purely like mechanicals, that's us. That's for us, maybe.
Oh, I thought it was his POV.
It's not necessarily. It's not necessarily. It is a very strangely, it's one of the only real shocking close-ups in the movie. And it comes out of nowhere. And it's, you know, that's what's happening. But like, technically, he lays them on the bed and then you're just looking, then you see them. But it's the audience who sees them, not necessarily him.
Okay.
But anyway. That's a little bit. That was a little bit too much, even for us. And I apologize.
Well, I have a couple of questions for you, Lou.
Can I ask though? When was the last time you saw the movie, Lou? You said it's been a while.
Joanne Woodward was the artistic director of the Westport Country Playhouse, and in order to raise money, they showed the film, and. I guess that was probably somewhere in the early 2000s. And that was when I saw the movie. And Paul Newman, Milo O'Shea, Sidney, and Paul Newman were on a, you know, they were
on a panel.
On a panel. And so was I.
That's wow. Sidney Lumet, the director, for people who aren't sure. So my big question for you, is did you get to drive that car?
It was very embarrassing because I can't drive a stick.
Oh.
And they had to be a Jaguar. And they were looking all over New England for a Jaguar that had automatic transmission.
Oh, my God.
I did pull out. I did do that. Yeah. I did do that.
Why did it have to be a Jaguar? Was some deal with Jaguar that they must have had some advertising deal for the film?
I think it was a David Mamet. You know, David Mamet wrote the screenplay.
Yeah.
So these things that you're talking about, you know, right. David Mamet is kind of a survival of the fittest, you know, social Darwinist, has that political point of view.
Yes.
No, I just think that they felt that Dr. Gruber, the character that I play, this very successful surgeon who is that chief witness that he talks about and then is bought off by the archdiocese, that would be the type of car that would make a statement that driving a Jaguar.
That was one of the more terrifying groupings of walk and talk that I've had to see an actor do. I thought of what how long were you on set for that long sequence when you come out of the, I guess it's, is it the hospital or the courthouse you're walking out of? I forget. You're coming out of
actually Boston City Hall. Okay. And what they did was they made it into a general hospital.
But I see.
The City Hall in Boston.
And it was just like an area of City Hall they weren't working in at the time.
Right. They made it seem like it was a hospital. And they made it seem like it was a locker room. I think that's where the scene began.
Yeah.
And you have to walk through the corridors and down steps and through a foyer into a car. And it's broken up into like four shots, I think, or more. But
no, he used the master. There was really only two shots. There was the shot in when I'm putting on my clothes in the locker room. But walking down the hall, walking down the steps, that was all one continuous master.
And then there's through the window. Then there's through the window of, I think, it as you're coming out of the door and you finish the scene by the car.
Uh-huh. Well, you know the film better than I, you know. But
it was a lot of walking and talking, and I those scared the hell out of me, and I was very impressed. I thought it must have been a very technical night.
Well, one of our viewers...
I had 90% of the dialogue, so that's what caused me a certain degree of stress.
One of our viewers here, this woman, Amelia Campbell, I have no idea who that is, would like to ask Lou what it was like to work with Sidney Lumet and Paul Newman.
It was great. Now, let me tell you something about the way Sidney Lumet worked, which is highly unusual. We rehearsed the screenplay of The Verdict like a play. We did it at 890 Broadway. And for a week, with James Mason and Charlotte Rampling and Jack Warden and Milo O'Shea, we were all in the room, like we were, you know, working on a Broadway play. And I had to walk around. I had to simulate what that long shot eventually was. So Sidney had Paul Newman and I walking around the rehearsal studio. And at first, I was very excited to be working with Paul Newman. So I would kind of wait, and I'd hold up, and I wanted to make eye contact with him just as a matter of respect. And Sidney said, no, you're a successful, very successful surgeon. He's a drunk, and you've got no time for him. Don't look back at him. Let him catch up to you. Well, we must have done it about two or three times in rehearsal in the studio. And I was still overly respectful. And Sidney took me aside and he said, look, this is the situation. He said, you're going to get into that Jaguar and you have 2 hours. before your next surgery, and you're having an affair with a young intern in Cambridge. You have 2.5 hours to get to Cambridge, make love to that girl, come back for your next operation, and I never look back at Paul Newman again.
It's like he knew you.
No, he was. Look, any good director, yeah, maybe he did know me.
No, I'm kidding.
Any good director, if they're going to give you a direction, it has to be an active direction.
Yeah, no, that's a phenomenal direction.
Yeah, it can't be. Think of yourself as a meteorite, you know, hurtling through space. It has to be, you want to screw the girl, you only got 2.5 hours.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That is fantastic. That it's funny, that trap of falling into, you guys talk amongst yourselves. There's a guest who wants to get on. Oh, and really? There's another guest who wants to join us.
Excellent.
Yeah.
So, all right. When I saw this, I see walk and talks like that and I get scared because I'm not fond of doing them. And I realize, of course, you had rehearsed because Sydney rehearsed a lot of stuff longer than most people got a chance to. We just watched Dog Day Afternoon again, and they rehearsed that in a studio for, I think, three weeks. They got all the bank stuff down like a play. How was it working on Serpico? Was it, did you have a relationship with Sydney on that as well?
Two takes, and that was it.
No kidding, really.
He wanted Serpico, he wanted the texture of it to seem like the local news. So he didn't, you know, and also Sydney had a deal in which if he brought a film in under budget, he got the excess. So, you know, there was an incentive to work quickly.
But
I do have to tell you, you know, when we finished that long tracking shot with, you know, so much of the dialogue my own, when we finally got to the Jaguar and I peeled off in the Jaguar, I heard over the biscuit Sidney Lumet saying, "That's it. I'm not going to do any close-ups." And I said to Paul Newman, "Oh, I'm so relieved. We don't have to do any close-ups." And he looked at me like I was insane because his entire life was close-ups, you know. Yeah. And I guess that's the difference between me and Paul Newman. Or as your father said, now this is so interesting. When I was working with Alan and the Sunshine Boys, and I was much younger, I mentioned to him in the conversation that I was, that some people thought that I looked like Paul Newman. And Alan said, "Yeah, you're the Paul Newman of the Lower East Side."
That's remarkably good. That's a frightening impression. How were you nervous working with Paul Newman when you first got there
Yeah, I was nervous. I was very nervous working with all of those incredibly accomplished actors. However, the one person that I absolutely could not believe that I was in the same room with was James Mason. And when the rehearsal was over in the studio, I went over to him and I said, "Mr. Mason, I just have to tell you that it is a privilege to be working in the same project as you." And he put his arms around me, and I'm going to do a very bad imitation now, but he went, "You know, Sydney is making $1 million and Paul is making $3 million, which doesn't leave very much for the rest of us." And I thought, "Yeah, you're making $750,000 and I'm making $7,500, you know."
Yeah. Yeah, that must have been something. I'm sure he was a gracious guy. He seems like he must have been very kind of gentlemanly person.
Well, to me, he's the definitive, you know, certainly the definitive Brutus. There'll never be a better Brutus than Julius Caesar. The other person, though, that I did get to know before shooting my scene was Charlotte Rampling. And I spent some time in her dressing camper for about 4 hours. She was the most fascinating woman, really erudite. And at the wrap party, I remember she walked across the room and I thought she probably doesn't even remember who I am. And she said, "Lewis," she said, "it was such a pleasure to get to know you." And I melted.
She was really a fascinating presence on screen.
You know, really the end of the movie, the end of the movie is her idea. That's not in the original script.
I heard something about that. Yeah.
She said, "Let me call," and he doesn't pick up the phone. Isn't that how it ends? Something like that?
Yeah, that's exactly how it ends. Yeah.
That was her idea. She suggested that to Sidney Lumet, and they used it.
It's a brilliant idea. It's a great device.
And he's drinking coffee.
Yeah, that's right.
At the end.
Yeah.
And she's drinking booze.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, there. I think it needs to be said, there's a pretty sort of alarming moment when he hits her. I found that not to be something that translated as into this age's viewing as maybe it did before.
Oh, yeah. You go to prison for that now. You know, it's, your whole career will be ruined.
It wouldn't work so well now. Yeah. How do you feel about how that character is woven into the piece? My only hesitation about the movie really has to, and I think Rampling is great in it. I just have some confusion about how it was handled in the movie, and I think that would be the screenplay, which I feel otherwise to be absolutely kind of a perfect script. And maybe I'm missing something. I don't know. The jump in logic for me was a little bit, how come Jack Warden's like involved with her now? They had one date and like all of a sudden it's just kind of assumed. There seemed something in an abrupt shift into their relationship, and I might have missed something. I don't know.
Well, Jack Warden is in the bar talking to her because Paul Newman can't get there.
Yeah, I know, but I mean, the way it was handled and dealt with, it was just like suddenly.
Look who's here. Except, I think we're having a problem with her.
I can see Roxanne's name, but I can't see Roxanne.
She's frozen. Maybe it's a bad internet connection. Yeah. Well, that's a drag.
Yeah, that's too bad. I haven't seen Roxanne since 1980.
Well, maybe we'll leave it there and maybe it'll clear up.
Maybe it'll clear up. We love you, Roxanne. I'm sorry that we can't see you and talk to you right now.
Yeah, I can see that she's there.
Roxanne is also great in this movie.
Phenomenal.
Just like knocks it out of the park in several scenes. I'd forgotten how many scenes Roxanne, you were in this movie, and we were just talking about how well it holds up. First shots, talk about first shots in movies that.
There she is. Wait. Hey.
Hey.
Roxanne.
I forgot. Oh, there I am. Am I there?
There you are. You're here.
Hi, Roxanne.
Hi.
Talk about first shots in movies that. Oh, there she is.
Yeah, right? You need to to turn it off.
I'm frozen.
You need to turn it off on the other computer.
Hi.
Turn it off on the other computer.
It's frozen. It's like this is driving you guys crazy.
Can you chat to her? Can you type that out to her, Matt?
You need to turn it off.
Turn what off?
You need to turn it off on the other computer.
Turn it off on the other computer. Okay. Hi.
Turn it off on the.
No, she turned it off on the wrong.
Just did.
See, I had a 45-minute tutorial with Matthew. That's the reason why I'm computer savvy.
Yeah. So, well, hopefully she'll get back here. But yeah. I just have to bring up that the opening shot of the movie. With the closing shot and the bookends of those two things, I mean, that first shot says more about a character than in almost any other first shot in the movie I can think of. Him playing pinball in a kind of dark bar during the day in a suit. I've never seen a person in a suit play pinball before. You know, drinking a flat beer and it's wintertime outside and no one's around. I'm like, that is a perfect character description for him.
Yeah. And there was also some very obvious subtext in that we keep seeing him playing pinball and doing terribly. And the night after he sleeps with Charlotte Rampling, he wins the pinball game for the first
time. Yes, he does.
It's equal almost to the train going into the tunnel at the end of North by Northwest.
Subtle sexual overtones.
Yeah.
So do you remember the DP? I was so impressed by how this movie looked and how it was shot. And I mean, do you remember the director of photography at all? Lou, did you talk with him? He did some impressive stuff.
Hey, I was a nervous wreck. I had my 4 minutes and I'm glad I got through it. And,
I thought you rehearsed. Was the technical team not there for the rehearsals?
Oh, well, I wasn't aware of it.
No. Oh, okay.
We rehearsed it like a play.
And there's Roxanne again. She's back. But I think she has a Roxanne, can you hear us?
Hello, Roxanne. Well, this is getting better. We can.
Yes.
You can hear us now?
Okay.
There you are. Can you hear us? You can't hear. Okay.
We can write messages. We can type out stuff.
I'm not sure why she can't hear. All right. You're talking about the cinematography, and there was a terrific moment that I had working with Sydney and watching him deal with cameras when we were working on 100 Center Street. Mm-hmm. And it was, I learned so much from this one little thing about filmmaking and directing, where it was a three camera sequence, and Sydney was setting up all three cameras and telling everybody where he wanted them to be. And he's saying, you know, okay, Roger, you're over there on sticks, and David, you'll be bagged over there, or you'll be on the dolly, and Michael, you'll be there on a half apple, and the camera operator says, no, I think a pancake will do it, and Sydney was already turning away, and he stopped, and he turned around and looked at the guy, and he said, really? The guy said, yeah, I think a pancake will do it, and Sydney said, okay, and went on, you know, and then we did the rehearsal. And at the end of the rehearsal, the cameraman is swapping out the half apple for a pancake because, of course, Sydney was right because he knew everything. And he knew everybody's job better than they did. But what I learned from it was he didn't argue with the guy. He just said, okay, because he knew the guy would figure it out in rehearsal.
Uh-huh.
And then it wouldn't work. So it was really interesting to see somebody wield their power that way. or not wield it because he didn't have to.
Or choose and, when to have to do it, you know, pick his moments wisely.
Yeah.
I mean, his level of experience is absolutely stunning. And he's always been one of my favorite directors, but you know, the older I get and the more experience I have, the more just amazed I am at the body of work and the different styles and genres that he was able to take on. Are you an overall fan of Lumet's movies, Lou, or are you? It's hard not to.
From 12 Angry Men on.
Yeah.
I worked with Sidney's father.
Oh,
I made my professional debut as Mendel the Rabbi's son in the First National Company of Fiddler on the Roof, and the rabbi was Bordecha Lumet, who was Sidney's father.
Wow.
And my job, he had cataracts on his eyes. He was very elderly. And my job was to get him on and off the turntable. And I always, our arms were always interlocked. And I was there about a week. And all of a sudden, he whispered under his breath, "You're standing in my light." And he was blind.
I didn't know his dad was an actor.
Yes.
I had no idea.
Yeah. Yiddish theater.
That explains some things. Yeah. This was his.
On Broadway, too, called Once Upon a Tailor. Yeah.
Hmm. I read that this was something, this is like Lumet's like 25th or 26th feature film. That's a lot of movies. That's a lot of films. And this was like middle of his career. And he'd already done more television than most people have.
And so varied. I mean, Murder on the Orient Express is such a wonderful film and so different from any director.
Yeah. And this was something like Paul Newman's 45th feature. Just if numbers mean anything. Milo O'Shea, one of the greatest
ever. God.
Greatest judge I've ever seen in a movie.
Yeah. Yeah. The sequence where he has to give the jury instruction to ignore the testimony of the witness is just so brilliantly done. The way they orchestrate that, and you know that Paul Newman now is going to win because of that.
Yeah,
and that Milo O'Shea has switched sides.
Mm-hmm.
It's very, very well done.
It's very smart.
There's also some really just great use of camera angles from below and above to change the power in sequences. When that great shot of Newman when he's looking up at Warden, looking up the staircase, saying "Help me, help me," and then the shot of Mason coming in on the witness, and he's just looming above her. They just do a great job with that. And then there's another shot that is so interesting is when the sequence where he gets on the phone when he thinks the case is lost and he goes back to the insurance company in the middle of the night and gets the president of the insurance company and Lumet just puts the camera on the floor in the corner of the office, you know, it's all the way back in the corner of the office, wide shot, and you're just observing this moment of pathetic.
See, that's one of the great scenes in the movie and one of Paul Newman's greatest moments, I think. That scene is absolutely incredible.
Yeah.
It's in one shot. There's a lot of oners in this movie, but we're used to that with him. He's so great at them. Long master shots, you know, long, really, really respecting the actors, like really letting so much happen in these wide shots, you know. I working with him when I did, you know, I had a little, I had a day on 100 Center Street, and, you know, incredible opportunity working with him. It was like an out of body experience. I don't remember much of it because it was really terrifying, but it went by so fast because they were shooting with five cameras, I think, at once. And so they got all the coverage they needed in like three takes.
Yeah,
it was crazy. A long scene. It was a big haul to get through, but it was really quick. I would love to see, and I know he did that because he was getting back to his roots from live television, which was all in the moment, and his cutting style for 100 Center Street. I mean, I remember we were shooting in this Japanese restaurant on the second floor of the shopping mall, and he was in a van outside on the street.
Yep.
And he edited the entire scene in real time while we did it, which was mind-blowing until you realize that's what he did with much more, you know, difficult to maneuver with gear in the 50s and the 60s with live TV. It's incredible. It's absolutely mind-blowing what he accomplished and how many things he did.
I was talking to Mom earlier today, and she was talking about when he was directing television that our grandfather was one of the producers on, and she was 10 years old and watching him in the control booth. And yeah. She said, I had such a crush on him because he was just the master of that control room. He just knew exactly what he was doing.
Back when he was a kid too, he started really young, and he was like this beatnik, you know, this crazy beatnik kid who infiltrated the system.
Yeah.
He was a child actor.
I remember that.
Ratty kid in George Washington Slept Here on Broadway. And I think he was in a William Saroyan play too.
Wow.
You know how did he work into his teens or into his 20s, or was he already on? You don't know.
I don't know.
A lot of great directors started out that way. Another Sidney started out as an actor. Sidney Pollack was acting before he was directing, and also worked in TV. I believe.
You know, there was another detail in the movie that I noticed where I was looking at the production design, and there's a picture I want to pull up, because this is his office. And I couldn't find a picture that showed it from the right angle, but that window that you see on the right of the frame, and you see this gorgeous archway outside the window. So, you know, we're in this amazing federal style building with these huge arches and pillars. But the wall of his office, so the arch is a full arch outside that window, but the wall of his office cuts about a third of the arch off. And what it tells you is that the building has been chopped up into small offices. So even the building he's in was once glorious, and now is well past its time. And to see that kind of attention to detail
you can see it in the shot we were talking about when he's on the phone with the loan officer.
Right. Yeah.
That's the angle where you see that archway, which is incredibly operatic. And also, that's the amazing thing about it to me too, is that it's an incredibly bold choice. It's not only great storytelling, but it's also gothic and like incredibly like a Citizen Kane move out of nowhere in this movie that's otherwise pretty, you know, pretty realistic in its portrayal. That office is like, it's like a dream office.
Roxanne's trying to get in again. She says she moved to another part of the house, so maybe she'll still be able to join us. So until Roxanne gets here, though, I think we need to shift gears a little bit and talk, because I know this is one of Lou's favorite subjects, talk a little bit about food, because Tony and I have been doing some very serious work in the kitchen during the pandemic. And I know Tony had an adventure tonight.
I did. I'm trying to find the actual recipe, but this was thanks to you, actually, because we were talking the other day, and we're like, well, what are you going to make, and what are we going to talk about on the show? I'm like, I don't really have any brilliant ideas. I'm tired. I just kind of want to have a can of chili. And he was like, no, don't do that. Do something better than that. I was like, what do I do? And he's like, why don't you make like a ropa vieja? And that, you know, somebody says that kind of thing to you and you're like, come on, what? That's a great night out. That's not something you do. Like for some reason, there's certain dishes that I just don't think that I could ever make. I don't know what
you and I used to meet all the time at a restaurant called La Nueva Rampa, which was a Chino Latino place down. Yeah. Up. Look who's here now.
Okay.
Oh, thank goodness.
Welcome.
Oh my God.
Hi.
Upstairs. Hi.
So nice to see you. Did you have to go to another computer?
I know. I brought his computer upstairs. I don't have all the access stuff to his computer. I'm not used to it. It's a totally different animal to me. Anyway. Hi, Lou. How are you? How are you guys? It's been interesting so far. I've been learning a lot. I have a few things, a few little anecdotal stories, but are you going on to food now?
No, but now we need to hear what you have to say about the verdict.
Okay.
You told me you have an interesting story.
I have a couple of interesting stories, and I was really hoping to get in touch with James Handy, who played my husband, because he had the most wonderful story about how he got cast in it. I'm just going to tell it because I just think it's interesting because it's about a different time. I can't imagine this happening today, but he was doing a play at the 92nd Street Y. He had come back from Vietnam and he had gone to Hunter College, and he started doing plays. Somebody asked him to read. There weren't a lot of guys there. Somebody asked him to read, and he did these plays and he started working. And went, oh, you know, I like this. And so he graduated from Hunter as an actor. He was on the GI Bill, and he was doing this play at the 92nd Street Y, and he found out that Sidney Lumet had been to see the play. And he had been trying for weeks to get in on the verdict, and he wasn't able to get in, and because he was an unknown, he didn't have an agent, and he went to the guy who ran the 92nd Street Y, and he said, you know, I know Sidney was here, and I know he's a patron of the theater, and you don't happen to have his address, do you? And the guy said, if I give it to you, you better never tell him that I gave it to you. And he said, I swear. So he walked his way uptown to Sidney's townhouse.
Wow.
With his little picture in his resume, rang the doorbell. Sidney's daughter came out of the door, and he said, you know, he was just there. He knew that her father had seen the play the night before, and he would really like a chance at auditioning for this particular role. And she took the picture, and the next day he got a call, and he went in to come in and audition. And when he walked in, he felt that the casting director, Lou, who was the casting director? Do you remember?
I don't.
Okay, well, he felt like she was giving him dirty looks because he had weaseled his way in. And he went in and he auditioned. And after he read, this guy jumped out from behind a screen, and it was David Mamet. And he said, that's it. That's the guy. And he got
the part. Oh, my God.
Isn't that a wonderful story?
That's crazy. See, that's the kind of thing that never works for most people, but once in a while.
And doesn't, what, can you imagine even being able to do that kind of thing today, to get access to, first of all, to have somebody come out their front door in a brownstone in New York, just wouldn't happen.
Right.
And to take a resume and to giving it to her dad. I mean, it just was such a different time.
Well, fantastic for him, because he really shines in it too. The two of you are great in that movie.
He was wonderful, and he's a terrific guy. I had just seen, I got that story just
actually about a year and a half ago, that story about how he got the part, because I went to see him in a reading here in Los Angeles. Lou, are you in New York?
I'm in New York, yes.
Oh, hi. but I heard some of your wonderful stories. It was my first film.
That's right. That's what I thought. Yeah.
Yeah, I had never done film work before.
What a first experience to have on a film, my God.
And you know, you reflect back, and I just I had no idea how unusual an experience it was.
Really?
The idea of having 2 weeks rehearsals, going into those Broadway rehearsal studios, having it all taped out, having it there, working out all the shots.
Did you come away, like, did you think that that's what every movie was going to be like after that?
I thought that's what movie making was. And it turned out so not to be. Yeah. But, you know, and reading his book later on, there were a couple of things that happened that I reflect back on, and I think, wow, he was acting the part of the director in a way.
Mm-hmm.
I was sitting at a table. Now, I'm 28 years old. I'm sitting at a table with Paul Newman and Sidney Lumet, and we're going over our scenes. We're doing our scenes, and Sidney stops and he goes, "Where did you come from?" And I'm going, "What, you know, why are you saying that?" He said, you're incredible. Where did you come from?" And Paul kind of looks at him and he said, "Well, wait a minute, what am I, chopped liver?" And I was so flustered, you know, I just didn't know the middle. I mean, I felt really like, oh gosh, he thinks I'm good. Skip to 30 years later, I'm reading his book on directing. And in it, he says, "What is the most important thing a director can give an actor? What is the most important thing an actor needs?" Confidence.
Wow.
And I went, holy shit. That's what he was doing. He was complimenting me in front of Paul. Paul may have even been in on the joke, or not the joke, but the setup to make movies, because he knew I had never been on a set. I didn't know what it was going to be like to have 30-odd people milling around, setting things, lights, cameras. You know, I would have to go.
Yeah.
It was me and Paul.
Yeah.
It had to be me and Paul, not me and Mr. Newman. It had to be me. I had to feel strong enough that I could fulfill that character, or feel confident enough. And he bestowed that on me in that simple act of complimenting me so fully in front of this major star.
Is this the book that you're talking about? The Making Movie?
Yes,
this is a great one. It's fantastic.
Yeah.
I would admit, the thing about him that's so fascinating to me is that I know he did things like that, which another person doing it would feel very manipulative, and somehow he directed from such a warm place. In my experience, my limited experience, I didn't work with him as long as you did, but you know, it really did seem genuine. Like, I don't think he would have been saying that if he also didn't kind of really believe you were fantastic. You know what I mean?
That's very sweet of you. And I do think he probably thought I was a good actress because he gave me the part. And, you know, and I didn't have a whole lot of experience. So, yes, that's true.
He didn't cast a lot of chumps in his stuff.
Pardon, what?
He didn't cast a lot of chumps in his stuff.
No, he didn't. He didn't. But there was something about him complimenting me in front of Paul, it being the three of us, and him going, so he really went a little bit, I'm kind of making it sound a little less than it was. He was really full-throated in it. Mm. So it gave me legs to stand on.
Do you know
but you earned them, though. The two of you, you and James, in that film, that you feel like you were plucked off the streets of Boston and plunked down in that movie. I mean, it's so heartfelt and so authentic and so of that neighborhood that you had to be coming from. Really incredible.
I also heard you say, Lou, something about James. James Mason.
Oh, yes. Yes.
He was extraordinary. He was so kind to me.
Oh, so that's
nice. I ended up having a long letter writing experience with his wife after he passed, actually. Which was very soon after. He was really a sweet, lovely man.
I recently saw him in Odd Man Out. Have you seen that film? Man Out?
No.
Oh, he's a young man. And, you know, it's about Ireland and, you know, the fight for independence.
We have a question here. Somebody was asking, was the movie totally shot in the New York City metro area? Your scene was shot up in Boston, right, Lou?
Yes.
Right. But the bar scene, I know.
All the interior sets, apparently, a lot of it was in New York City, in Silver Cup, was what I heard.
Yes.
Right. And the bar is a New York City bar.
That wasn't a set. I thought that the one window was a real bar. Huh?
The AD's bar. He also owned that bar, yeah.
It's also the bar in which Danny Aiello tries to strangle Frank Pentangeli and says, Michael Corleone says hello.
Well, the guy who is also Sydney's, and I can't recall his name, but produced a lot of films with Sydney, or was his production assistant. He probably used that bar.
Bert Harris.
Bert
Harris was his AD.
It was his bar.
Yeah. And his dad worked with Bert Harris a bunch too. Dad loved him. Dad says he was the greatest, and was almost like a great filmmaker, like a great director under his own right, because his ability to deal with crowds and to give inventive things for extras and people and crowds to do, he said, was unrivaled. He said it was absolutely.
And he plays the bartender in the movie.
Yeah, that's right.
Now, Lou, were you on set the day of the big sort of shaming with that Sydney did to Paul?
Oh, this sounds interesting.
No, tell me about that.
Oh, okay. This, I've also come to believe, was staged. Huh. You know that story that's been told, that Sydney would put money in a parking meter if he was at a cat house. Because he just never, you know, he was always on time and everything. And we had to reshoot that one crane shot. Well, Sydney, you know, we had days, endless days of being in a courtroom where there was just a lot of observation that we had to do. And, you know, we were living in that experience. And one day when the courtroom was completely full, and this was early on, and we knew we were going to have like maybe 2 weeks in that courtroom. Paul says, Sydney, what is this? Is this just set dressing? Why are we here? And Sydney turned to Paul. Everybody is there, the cast, everybody, and says, you're paid to support your fellow actors. So take your feet off the goddamn table and play the role. And Paul Newman did. And I remember, and that's also why I wanted to have James here, because he would say, yeah, because I'll tell you, we grabbed each other. We were sitting in the aisle there. We were like terrified. We couldn't believe that Sidney Lumet had yelled at Paul Newman in front of everybody. And Paul took his feet off the table and then sat upright in his character.
Wow.
But I've come to believe that that was probably something that they did in order to get everybody else to be in line. Like, well, if
you certainly would listen to the man that yells at Paul Newman.
Right.
There's no doubt about that.
Right.
Yeah. That's amazing. Oh, Alana has a question.
Yeah.
How do Roxanne and Lewis feel about Paul's performance at that stage in Paul's life and career, since it was such a departure? That's a great question. And hello, Alana. Yeah, because this was I guess another resurgence of him. He had had a few, but you know, I think people were really surprised to see him come out with this level of work at this point in his life. At least that's what I remember. There was a lot of discussion about it.
You want to go?
Oh, he was a great actor. And I mean, I think that he should have won the Academy Award for that performance. And they gave him the Academy Award for a film, which was Minor, a number of years later. But he was a great actor, but he was more than a great actor. I mean, think of what a useful life Paul Newman lived with all of these, with a camp for, you know, children who have cancer, and what started out as the salad dressing in which all the profits, you know, go to charities. He was a really a great man, I think.
I think that, you know, there's a lot also too that I discovered about their relationship and about Sidney wanting, in the book that you just held up, Tony, a minute ago, he talks about Paul as being a very shy person, being retiring, and I guess they were traveling together. They would take the town car. Sidney would go uptown, and Paul would go further to Connecticut, mm-hmm. or wherever it was that he. And the first day after he talks about in the book about how Paul was kind of on the surface, kind of skimming the surface, and he really told him that he had to dig deeper, and he had to go for it. And the next day, supposedly, or I guess Sidney felt that he came in and he really went for it. And I feel that that's what you see. And you see,
I do too. I mean, no disrespect to any of his earlier performances, or he is, I think, a great actor. And as I've gotten older, I've come to respect him even more and more. But there's something about this performance coming out at his age and at the time in his career where a lot of people don't feel they have to work that hard.
Right.
And he, I think, was coming out swinging when a lot of people were kind of making fluffier things, perhaps. He didn't have anything he had to prove at that point, and he came on like he did. And do you agree with that? Do you both think that a special performance for him, or just 100?
For such a beautiful man, he allowed himself to be ugly,
mm-hmm.
really ugly, and yeah. And that's kind of brave in
a way.
The sequence in the Archdiocese office where he doesn't take the check.
It's so good. It's so good. Come on.
Just heartbreaking.
Because it's so what he doesn't want to do. He doesn't want to not take that money, but he can't. It's literally killing him that he can't take it, but he won't do it. It's so much going on. There's so much going on there.
That's a heartbreaking, wonderful, wonderful sequence. There's some really interesting racial/class ethnic stuff in it. You know, there's the stuff about the Jews, there's the African-American doctor and how that is handled and how he handles that. And immediately when the doctor is gone, he says, you know, we're going to need that nerd. I mean, it's so complicated.
When that doctor shows up from out of town, and the fact that he's Black has an impact on the story in a way that isn't even discussed, but is this weirdly felt thing for people, was so well done, uncomfortable, bizarre, but also really, really really interestingly handled in the film, I thought.
And his performance is amazing.
He's fantastic.
It's spectacular.
Everybody's work. The woman who plays the nurse that won't talk to him.
Yeah.
She has that scene in the doorway where he comes to talk to her at night, and she, I forget her name. She's been in a lot of films. Fantastic. These one scene performances from people that are just one after another, just so fantastic. Do you remember everybody being there for these rehearsals? Like, or was it just the main people in the scenes? Was it everybody?
Well, everybody was there for the first read through. I don't know if we had a second full read through, but then he divided it up and it was just, you know, he rehearsed scenes and figured out blocks. Right, Lou? Did he do that with you?
I was there only the last week because my stuff was so contained, you know. I was really only on the shoot for 2 days. So I didn't interact with a lot of people. I found 16 films. Under no circumstances did we ever rehearse those films beforehand, which to somebody like myself, who I'm an accomplished theater actor, I'm hardly an accomplished film actor, you know. So, like you say, confidence. And, I remember in a documentary about Marcello Mastroianni, he talks about the soul of an actor, of allowing your soul to be captured by the camera. And I never felt that that was my strong suit.
Those actors who we were talking about, it's Joe Seneca plays Dr. Thompson. And Julie Bevasso plays Maureen Rama. Yeah, and they're both of them, everybody's work in it.
She's in Dog Day Night too.
Yes, she's really wonderful in Dog Day Afternoon, yes.
Yeah. We need to get to some food here, though. Because you were talking about the Ropa Vieja. Do you have a photograph of the Ropa Vieja?
I emailed you a photo.
You emailed me a photo of the Ropa Vieja? Mm-hmm. Okay, let me find that.
So, did you ever go to La Caridad, either of you, when you were in Manhattan and eating for pennies? No, it was the restaurant.
Yeah, I did.
La Caridad. So this was a dish that you could have there, potentially. And Matthew said, why don't you make that? And I said, I can't do that. And he said, you probably can. Did you get the picture?
I did get the picture. And I'm about to...
What is your estimation? You probably made this before. You probably could tell me how I did.
Is this photograph from the recipe or is this the ropa that you made?
That's what I made, but thank you for asking.
Well, this just looks too good.
I pay him handsomely to say these things.
Hold on a second here. We're gonna take a look at this because I want to come over right now.
It's not gonna be here when you get here. I'll tell you that much. So here's the thing.
Look at that. That's insane. That looks like it's out of a magazine.
Is it black beans on rice with shredded pork?
It's beef. It's black beans and rice and stewed shredded beef
with tomatoes. Wow, it looks delicious.
Impressive.
The thing is, you're supposed to cook this for like 8 hours, and I messed it up because can we talk about products? Am I going to get you in trouble if I say the product name?
No, I think you're allowed to say a product.
Instant Pot, great, love it. But you know what? It's a pressure cooker. Let's be realistic. It's a pressure cooker. It's not, they say it does, like they say it will make milk and butter and eggs and cheese. It'll make it'll make a pizza. It doesn't do anything.
You know what I have made in the Instant Pot that's spectacular?
What?
You know the sous vide egg bites that they have at...
I honestly don't have time for sous vide, though. I think that's going to... That's actually too much.
The sous vide egg bites that they're you make a whole bunch of them. There's a silicone insert that you make them. It's spectacular.
I'm sure it's great. It's not a slow cooker, is what I'm saying. They advertise it that it slow cooks. It's not. That's not true.
You're gonna get us sued by Instant Pot now.
You said I could talk about products. It's a fine machine. It's a great machine. It's not tuned perfectly as far as I've experienced to slow cooking. So I did a pressure cooker version of this, which isn't ideal because it needs to condense as it cooks a little bit, which it's not going to do.
Oh, okay.
Well, tomorrow is going to be better than anything that you've had.
Well, this is what I'm going to send, a recipe that I'm going to send you, because this is one of the best things. You know how so often you cook something and by the time it's done, you're not that into it?
Yes, that's happened.
This was better than I could have imagined. So it's a sheet pan dinner where everything goes on the sheet pan.
I got scared because I thought you were going to show me like a fully cooked meal at first and I didn't know what I was looking at.
No, this is before it went into the oven. Then this is after it came out of the oven. And then this is...
It doesn't look as different as I thought it would somehow.
Well, it and then this is it in the bowl. Hold on. When it was completely done... Here we go. This is sheet pan dinner, harissa roasted chicken thighs, sweet potato, and red onion, and then a green harissa yogurt sauce on top of it, which in the recipe they say is optional. And you know what?
No.
It's not optional.
I don't think that's optional.
It is not optional. It was one of the best things I've ever had.
What's the green sauce? What are the ingredients in the green sauce?
Yogurt, garlic, cilantro, lemon.
Wow.
And something else. Hold on, I can tell you in a moment what else.
Snapple, I think.
Yeah. Or Scrapple.
Yes.
What makes it turn green?
The cilantro.
Really?
Yeah.
I love cilantro.
Have you both been cooking during the pandemic? Has it been just a cook storm? Yeah.
Yeah.
I am so tired of my own cooking, let me tell you.
Ooh. Are you by yourself right now through this?
Yes.
So you, okay. How about you, Roxanne? You have family or somebody there?
I have a husband who's not here tonight, and otherwise I would have been able to get on a little faster. But I have two sons, but they're actually are both in New York now, New York area. So I have a backyard, so we've started cooking out on a grill too. We've done that.
I wish we could do that. We're not allowed to do that.
No.
I have a new wave oven. Do you know what that is?
No.
Sounds really hip though, man. Tell me what that is.
Cylinder that cooks from the top. And I really like it. And then I went and I bought, this was ridiculous. It was sheer folly on my part. A thing called a Brava oven, which costs over $1,000. But really all it is a computer. And I am totally computer illiterate.
That's problematic.
So I was so frustrated by it that I took it and I put it in the closet.
I'll pay the shipping cost, Lou. I know how to use a computer. I'll pay the shipping cost.
All right, I'll send it to you. I'll send it to you.
Well, we could clearly tell I would ruin everything with it.
How much does it weigh?
It's pretty heavy. It's very heavy. It is. And the thing about it is I was seduced because they have very good television advertising is that you can cook a lot of things at the same time. Well, who cares? You know, you can put it in a pot and you can put it in a frying pan. You know, the idea that I was seduced by, that's the one thing that the food somehow, machinations of how to cook somehow is very attractive to me. I'm easily seduced. But I just keep going back to the new wave oven.
The new wave oven. Oh my goodness.
You can buy it like for $100. Yeah.
You lost me at circular oven. I don't know what that is.
Is it like a circular cylinder, a plastic cylinder?
Uh-huh.
I can show it to you. Want me to show it to you?
It's right there. Yeah, let's see what this is about.
I'm going to jump in for one. While you go get it, I'm going to show this. I made one other thing, flatbreads in the skillet that you got.
Okay. This is, I'm going to do this.
That's really easy. Really easy, the flatbreads.
Wow.
Circular oven.
Let's see the circular oven.
Okay.
Right.
Look, it looks like a pressure cooker.
And then there's like a big
oven of tomorrow. There's nothing inside it though, Lou. There's no parts there. It looks like a windshield. Are you sure that's the right device?
I'll get a hernia bringing it over.
You said that that's a computerized oven. That's the computerized thing, or that's something else.
The computerized oven is this thing called Brava. You'll see it. They advertise it constantly on television, and it's this. Yeah, it's a beautiful looking thing.
Like a toaster oven kind of thing?
Yes, but more new age. NASA.
Yeah. I need a better toaster oven. I do.
Before I actually follow through on this shipping thing, how much does it weigh?
I would say it weighs 50 pounds.
Maybe I won't pay to have it. It should probably be cheaper to buy one.
It's
oh, no. It's $1,000.
It's $1,200. Yeah, and I don't have that much kitchen space, and I would just stare at it, you know, and feel like so incompetent, you know. And then I thought, I just want to get this out of my sight, you know. So I picked it up, but you know, wasn't easy to pick up, and I just moved it into a closet. And I'm a new man.
Lou and I were on the road together for 6 months. And we had so many eating adventures at places that don't exist anymore. Lou knew every time we were heading to a new city, about a week before we got there, Lou would be like, Carl's Chop House. Carl's Chop House. When we get to Detroit, we're going to Carl's.
That's great.
And then we're heading to Blackie's Steakhouse. Oh,
Blackie's House of Beef.
Blackie's House of Beef. That's right. And then when we were in Baltimore, I love tuna, like a good tuna salad sandwich.
Well,
and every city we'd come to, I would come back to the hotel and I'd be like, Lou, I found the tuna salad sandwich. And Lou and I hadn't spoken in 12 years. And he said, I remember the tuna salad sandwich that you found in Baltimore.
Question. Tuna salad sandwich, what's your favorite in New York? Let's talk. Let's really talk about it. Lou.
Oh. I got a very funny story. My mother was a terrible cook.
Okay.
The one thing she did make that was just wonderful was tuna salad, which, you know, she would send off to when I'd go to high school. I would have a tuna sandwich.
Okay.
She made.
Yeah.
For the next 40 years, I'm trying to find the exact, what was it made that such good tuna salad? Well, so I tried mustard, I tried vinegar, I tried onions, celery. I couldn't replicate that.
Oh, that's frustrating.
All right. So one day I looked in my, my kitchen cabinets and I had nothing. All I had, I didn't have any onions. I didn't have any celery. I didn't have any vinegar or mustard. All I had was mayonnaise and tuna fish. And that was it.
That was it.
The magic formula.
After all these years, that was the magic of the simplicity. It was there. That's amazing.
Oh, that's just
Roxanne, do you have a tuna salad sandwich story? Because I do. Well, I have a favorite one.
No, I don't. I don't have a tuna salad sandwich story.
Okay.
Okay. What's your favorite tuna salad sandwich?
Me?
No, Tony said he had.
Oh yeah.
You don't.
There's two. There's only two.
And okay.
The first one is Eisenberg's.
Yeah. Which, well.
Forget it. I think you can just basically go home. Not too dissimilar from your mom's tuna sandwich. Probably. It's very basic but amazing.
Yeah.
Is it a New York deli?
Yeah, it's a New York counter, like a counter diner, very 30s style place on Broadway and 21st Street around there,
yeah.
I guess.
Yeah.
Near the Flatiron Building. And it's a classic, like, you feel like you're back in the 30s. It's really very much a time warp place and not a place that you think you'd want to go in when you pass by. But if you brave it, it's fantastic. Yeah.
And a phenomenal pastrami sandwich as well.
Oh my God, it's so good. Then you got the Union Square Cafe. It makes a high-end tuna sandwich. You know, they're a very fancy restaurant.
Yes, I know that.
Really good, but they're also it's nearby, similar neighborhood, but they make a high-end one that's more money and it's just like...
It's a Kobe tuna fish sandwich.
Kobe fish, yeah.
I'm a little sad right now because when you were a little boy, I used to make you a tuna salad sandwich and you thought it was pretty good. And
Gateway sandwich.
I got
Gateway sandwich, Matthew. It was the start of a beautiful relationship that I've had with sandwiches for years.
Well, the Baltimore tuna salad sandwich was on a bread with the bread had Kalamata olives baked into the bread.
See, already you're winning.
Yeah, it's all coming back, Matthew.
I can tell you what I hate. Tuna salad that people put sweet pickles in.
Not so good for, yeah, okay.
That's sacrilege.
Hate it. Okay, hate is strong. And I prefer the savory tuna.
Oh my God, sweet pickles in a tuna sandwich, not good.
It's kind of like raisins in a bagel for me.
Yeah.
What about dill pickles?
Pineapple on a pizza.
Don't do it.
No.
What about dill pickle in the
sure.
Okay.
Put it in there maybe. Give it a try. Anyway, it's not sweet. It's not gonna be that
bad. I like a little celery, sometimes a little hard boiled egg.
Crunch is good in there.
Yeah.
You could try that, Lou. The mayonnaise is not always enough.
Nothing. I want nothing. I want no condiments. I found after 40 years I found it.
I made one more thing this week I'm going to share.
Please.
Which is...
That's lovely. Is that a barley and kale soup?
Lentil, kale, and hot Italian sausage.
You were making that when you were showing me how to do the thing that I didn't know how to do tonight.
That's right. When we were talking.
Yeah. So your soup came out better than my getting on the screen.
The soup came out pretty damn good.
I want to make it clear. I don't want to misrepresent the fact that I did not see the verdict and eat this dinner at the same time. That's not what happened. I watched the movie. I didn't want to distract myself. And I ate this at another time. I just felt that was important to note because I think there was confusion last week. People were like, you did both of these things at once. And that's not what happened.
And, I think when you cook for future shows, you should have the meal should be thematically attuned to what the movie is.
I'm far too lazy. If Matthew wants to do it, I'm lazy. That would never just come together as good an idea as that is.
So
Fool wants to know something. We have a comment. Thank you, Ms. Hart, and for mentioning James Handy.
Who is that?
From Bette Bowles.
Oh.
Yeah.
Does she know James?
She did not say, but she just wanted to thank you.
Just made a comment.
James Handy.
Oh. Yeah.
So, any food, Roxanne? What did you have to eat tonight?
I haven't eaten tonight. I haven't yet eaten.
Are you on the East Coast? This is unacceptable.
No. We made a meatloaf.
Okay.
Really good meatloaf that we get from a butcher, Standing's butcher here. We're not supposed to talk about
it. Oh, plug away. Tell them good reviews. I made the mistake of giving something bad.
A lot of pork. Anyway, made that. I made mashed potatoes and fresh asparagus. It's a winter meal, but that's what I'm going to go have after.
It's actually winter now in my soul.
Oh god.
It's all fine.
How's Lou? How are you guys doing? You brought your pandemic down a little bit. We're all shut down again out here.
Yeah. From March 7th, which was my birthday, in which I had two of my friends over, I cooked for them, until late June. I didn't have a physical interaction with another human being. And I walk around every once in a while. I did go to Maine to my friends Wally and Margaret Dunn. I got tested, which that's a good thing, you know, if you come out negative. I didn't want to be asymptomatic and visit anybody. But it's very isolating, and I don't turn on the news until 4 o'clock to watch Nicole Wallace, because I love watching disgruntled Republicans, you know. And I've been reading a lot, and I was telling the guys that I'm in the process of writing a second book. I have a published book, so that gives my day structure, and I have 3-4 hours a day. I can sit there and be involved in a project.
That's great.
What's the first book called, so people can get a
Acting
hold of it?
Acting Foolish. Acting Foolish. You can get it now on Amazon.com.
Great.
Oh, yeah.
Where can people find you, Roxanne, if they're looking to follow you on social or see you on something? Is there anything current?
Well, the last thing I did for Spectrum actually is making product now.
Mm-hmm.
And they did a limited series about the Atlanta bombings and Richard Jewell.
Okay. Yeah, I heard about that.
And I'm in that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Is that where can people that's on
Spectrum? On Spectrum.
On Spectrum.
Yes. And so it's a wonderful cast too. The actor who plays Richard Jewell, Cameron, I'm blanking on his last name, but I don't know if you saw the series that was about the beginning of the development of how they came to figure out serial killers. There was a series.
You mean Mindhunter?
Cameron Britton.
Cameron what?
Cameron Britton.
Yes, he's fantastic. He plays Richard Jewell, and Jay Saunders is in it. He plays his.
Oh, Jay's great.
And Carla Guignini plays the reporter. And Arliss Howard is my husband. He's he's kind of a bomb whisperer in a way. His role is kind of a compilation, because while the FBI wants to pin it on this one guy, Richard Jewell, wrongly, he keeps going in and telling them they got the wrong person. It's actually a really well done story. So if you want a limited series based on historical fact, and that
that's all anybody wants right now. That's fantastic.
Yeah.
And Arliss Howard is so great. It must have been fun working with
him. He's fantastic.
My son, I'll tell you a funny little thing. My son, who was primarily a musician for many years, came out of the closet, so to speak, and said that what he really wanted to be was an actor.
Uh-huh.
And he started acting just recently. And when I looked at the script, I said to Michael Dinner, who was the showrunner on this, I said, there's this part here and it might be right for my son. I think he might be temperamentally right for this. Do you think he could audition? And he said, sure. Wow. And he auditioned, he got the part. And then the part grew out of being, you know, this day player local hire into this 5-episode arc. And
That's fantastic.
That was a great story. Yeah.
Amazing.
And now the coronavirus hit. So,
yeah. And everybody's waiting around.
Yeah.
Before, I just need to mention the fact that it's such an interesting connection that I know you and Matthew know each other from Chappaqua, but we never met then. But I know you because your dad was my principal in high school.
Yeah.
And I think that the fact that you were an actor had a lot to do with me having a better time in school, because he let me get out of all kinds of things to go travel with my dad to go to movie locations. I think because he understood what acting was because of you. And I owe you a debt of thanks for that, because he probably would have never let me go anywhere.
I think my dad was starstruck by the whole thing. You know, he just, remember when I was doing Chicago Hope with your brother, Adam, and my parents came to the set and they were just over the moon. It was just so much fun to see everybody, see cameras and everything. And
yeah. Did he ever come to the set to visit you before? Like, did he come to the Verdict set or?
No, that was a closed. I was a very low on the totem pole. I would never have been
able. The principal, I can't imagine they wouldn't let him go anywhere he wants.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, it was fun. I was the first person. You came from, this was your family, so you came from, that world was new to you, or not new to you, it was familiar to you. And for my parents, it was a whole new thing. Sure. It was all so much fun.
Yeah.
That's amazing. Well,
he ran a great school, I have to say. He really did.
Yeah,
that's nice.
Very sweet man. He was always incredibly nice to me, way nicer than any other principal ever would have been to me.
Well, he wasn't so nice to me sometimes. I remember my senior year skipping school with a friend to go into Manhattan. I mean, this is how dangerous we were, and just take pictures. And we went down to Barney's on 7th Avenue and 17th Street and took pictures outside.
Oh, God.
And as we were coming back, driving back in, you know, that big, we're still on the same campus, right? Okay. So you're driving up the way and I see my father is at the top of the hill, and it's me and these two guys. And he sends them off or he says, you guys are going to have detention now. And you, young lady, I'm going to see you at home.
Oh, wow.
I love that John Hughes movie. I love that movie.
That's right. Well, we've been at this for an hour and a half, so we should probably wrap it up. I want to thank you, Roxanne, and thank you, Lewis, so much for joining in on us, joining in on this. I also want to let people know that on Monday at 5 o'clock on my Tips and Techniques for Actors, Authors, and Storytellers show, Gregory Harrison will be my guest, who's had an illustrious career of more than 40 years in film and television. So he'll be talking to any of the acting and filmmaking students who want to stop by and listen to us chat. And please subscribe to this channel. Click the bell icon when you do so that you get updates and notifications of the future live streams. And subscribe to our newsletter. If you subscribe to my newsletter, just go to MatthewArkinStudio.com. And when you subscribe, you will get a link to all the recipes we talked about on the show tonight.
And so, please give Gregory my love. We played husband and wife together in a TV movie.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, I will. Okay. Yeah, yeah. I'll be speaking to him. I spoke to him this afternoon, and then he'll be joining the show, just my tips and techniques show on Monday.
Great. I'll look forward to seeing it. Maybe I'll chat in if I can figure out how to do it.
Oh, yeah. That'd be great. I'll send you the link for when that's going to go up. And
I don't mean come on. I mean just say something like
say hey to him. Okay. Yeah. Tony and I have not decided what next week's movie is, but we will in the next couple of days, and it will be up there. We'll get the word out.
Try to get better at announcing what it is, you know, on the week before. But
announce on the show. We're new to this.
So we're not doing it yet.
Okay, that's great. Well, thank you, everybody. And we will talk to you all very soon. Join in next week.
Great to see you both.
Yeah, thanks. It was a pleasure. Nice seeing you.
Thanks, Lou.
Nice to see you, Lou.
Thank you, Roxanne.
Thank
Good
you.
Night, everybody.
Good night. Bye.
Good night, buddy.
You've been listening to the Arkin Brothers Talk About Movies. That's my brother, Matthew Arkin. And that's my brother, Anthony Arkin. And we are interesting, irreverent,
and irrelevant. But you can follow us on Instagram anyway. You can also subscribe to our newsletter and check out our merch.
And you can do it all on our website. Just follow the link on your podcast app.
If you want to know more about Matthew, like if you want to stalk him or something, you can learn more than you'd ever want to know at MatthewArkin.com.
And if you're a fan of my kid brother, Anthony, you can find him at Clem Torment on Instagram.